The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. Yes, it's still Hugh Hallman. For those of you who are shocked to miss the dulcet tones of Seth Liebson's voice emanating from your car speaker or your home speaker, I am joined by, or improved by, or preceded by, Lewis Hallman, who is sitting across from me. He is the Managing Director of Insight Analytics. That's Insight, I-N-C-I-T-E, Analytics.
Always a delight, and I hope to succeed you, not precede you.
You're preceding me in success, and you will also succeed me in success.
Fair enough.
You're a big banner to carry on under. All of my sons are much more successful than I am as human beings, and I am thrilled by that. The best thing a father can have is smarter and, in this case, taller sons. Who are proceeding on in life brilliantly. So we are wanting to get to what we sort of threatened to talk about in the first 2 hours. Those of you who weren't with us, we've been sort of presaging the notion that we really want to and need to talk about the continuing gnashing of teeth about Israel and the accusation that Israel is somehow engaged as a nation in genocide. And Lewis and I have been thinking about that a lot lately because the sort of commentary by the left is that Israel's effort to wipe out Hamas is really a disguised or intentional genocidal act or acts against Palestinians with the intention of committing genocide. And genocide is a very specific concept under international law, as learned from some genocidal acts that have taken place in modern human history, including the most understood and discussed series of acts of genocide by the Germans, the German society and its war machine, to exterminate the Jews, not just in Germany and all the areas in which Germany had ultimately conquered during World War II, but throughout the world. Lewis then has some notions about adding to that, if you would, Lou.
Absolutely. So before we get too deep into the conversation, I want to just step back and describe a bit of what I think has been going on with the whole discussion here. And I think that the word genocide is being thrown around rather casually in much the same way as the word fascism has been diluted recently.
And racism.
Fair enough. Absolutely. And what I think is happening is that whenever military conflict exists, people are using the word genocide, really irrespective of scale and irrespective of context. And what's fascinating about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that's been raging is that you actually see legal scholars advocating on both sides that both parties are committing genocide. And so, as we've said repeatedly about this conflict, you know, it's one of those sort of devices that really says more about you based on your commentary and analysis of it than you say anything about the conflict itself, right? The issue itself is so multifaceted and long running that everyone brings so much preconceived baggage to this conversation if you just look at the Wikipedia article for the conflict, you can see citations on both sides arguing that both the Israeli Defense Forces and Hamas are committing genocide, which is rather ludicrous.
So in the notion of international law, Lou, why don't you throw out the notions that the Geneva Convention contains for determining, defining genocide?
So it's actually not the Geneva Convention. It's the UN Genocide Convention in 1948. And they define genocide as any of five acts. And these are acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. Let me stop right there first. In whole or in part is very, very contentious. There are actually, when the concept was rolled out, there were positions taken that indeed a single death could constitute a genocide under that domain. Due to that in part concept, and indeed some prosecution has existed, though most of the international courts tend to take a stricter approach to the definition, where it does need to be substantive.
And we'll get into that.
You see Germany and other nations apply a much looser definition.
Yeah, we'll get
one other piece then on this definition so far. So we're destroying in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. Notice that a political or social group is not included in this definition, which is very, very interesting.
Okay, repeat it again so everybody gets the pieces.
So
national, ethnic.
So we have a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. Notably missing from this is political or social group. Now, why would that be? Why is that the case? Well, keep in mind, this convention occurred in 1948, where the other seat at the table in a bipolar world was Joseph Stalin, who about 10 years previously had just finished purging the Red Army of its entire upper officer corps, as well as the Holodomor and various other atrocities. And so there was a lot of back and forth to explicitly preclude the political portion so that the Soviet Union could keep its totalitarian punishment machine raging.
Because it didn't matter which nationality, ethnicity, racial group, or religion you were, if you were opposed to the communist growth of the Soviet state,
you're an anti-revolutionary.
You're an anti-revolutionary and therefore are murdered irrespective of the first four tests that would create genocide.
Right. So it's interesting to note, so before we even set the table, the entire legal definition of the term has been structured around that loophole. But so now let's talk about the five acts that then constitute genocide. Those are killing members of the group, causing them serious bodily or mental harm, imposing living conditions intended to destroy the group, preventing births, and forcibly transferring children out of the group.
The underlying theme in all five of those is that you are seeking to eradicate, whether it's a religious group, an ethnic group, or a racial group, or a nationality.
I am not a legal scholar at all, but the term that seems to be thrown around in the literature is physical biological destruction, substantive physiological and biological destruction.
And here is the piece that those on the left miss in understanding what genocide means. It starts with, quote, intent, unquote. That is, there has to be a knowledgeable intention to, knowledge is presumed an intention, by the way, an intention that you are undertaking acts to destroy. Whether or not you add the in part, you still have that feature. And so the aspect that the left misses is that when they say Israel is engaging in the genocidal acts, they are absolutely ignoring the massive effort that the IDF and the State of Israel generally is undertaking to avoid killing Palestinians. Since October 2nd to today, imagine if Israel was trying to actually undertake genocide. It would not have been very difficult to not merely end up with 30,000 dead Palestinians, but millions. We'll be back in just a bit, and we hope you will join the conversation with Lewis and me on KKNT 960 The Patriot. Here we are on Seth Liebson's show, and you're welcome to join us at 602-508-0960. We'll be back in just a moment. We are actually not Neil Diamond. We are Hugh and Lewis Hallman coming to you on KKNT 960 The Patriot. We thank Seth Liebson, our good friend, for allowing us to fill in for him. He is diligently doing community efforts to build team. And he and our young friend, young David, is in absentia today. And we are joined by Bill instead, who we hope will maybe actually engage as well. The last time we did that, Bill, was something about whether or not one was better off being a resident of a red city in a blue state or a blue city in a red state. And we disagreed on that outcome. As I recall, you believed it was better to be in a red city in a blue state. And I argue it's better to be in a blue city in a red state based on the power and controls. Am I right about that? Did I get that right? And have you changed your opinion? Did I convince you, or do you need now to convince me?
I think you brought me at least to 50-50, whereas before I was squarely on the, you know, red city, blue state.
So now you would be happy to be in a purple city in a purple state.
Oh, boy. That seems like the worst of all.
It is. In fact, it is a living hell.
I'm reminded of the Gary Larson comic, Welcome to Hell, Here's Your Accordion. We are in Arizona.
Yes. Welcome to Arizona, Here's Your Canteen. Oh, we forgot to put water in it.
Right. So a little bit of a tonal shift there as we come back from our last segment, in which we were sort of laying the foundation for a treatment and a conversation of the Israeli-Palestinian war and the legal context of the notion of genocide, which has been thrown around by many, many sides to describe the activity both on behalf of Israel and Hamas in this conflict. And it's our hope then that we can shed some light on what is actually going on and how we should appropriately categorize the situation.
And in my view, and Lewis, you'll correct me if you think I've gotten too far off track, we have two different societies, two different cultures. One, a culture that geared up for war in a very hostile way. The team of Hamas spent well over $1 billion creating a tunnel system under the Gaza Strip in which they could create munitions, store them, live and breathe underground, and then attack Israel while returning to the tunnel systems precisely developed under infrastructure that is entirely intended to be protected by human shields, innocent human shields. And they did that intentionally. It is clear and demonstrable to anyone who looks at this that you had a government system. They're in charge of the Gaza Strip that took $1 billion in aid that was intended to assist the people, the Palestinian people in Gaza. And they built a tunnel system that has been used exclusively as the means by which they can attack Israel and retreat under the protection of innocent lives above, with, in my view, the political intention that as Israel tries to defend itself and tries to rout out the Hamas fighters, they are certain to cause the deaths of innocent people, which Hamas intends to occur, so that that shocking headline can be used to bludgeon Israel with the West. And given our predilections, that the West is demonstrating that it's willing to be manipulated that way.
I absolutely agree with your characterization, and I would like to try and just make it as plain and simple as can be. So we have Hamas, who on the one hand enters Israel with an explicit goal of exterminating civilians and employing sexual assault en masse in its attack.
Brutality and sexual assault.
This then is right up in there with every definition of genocide that is argued about and is really constituent.
The intention to destroy in whole or in part a racial or religious group.
Right. And again, we then have the killing, the employment of sexual violence, and all of the other pieces of this that then make it
horrific.
Not only horrific, but legally a case for genocide. And so what we have then is, again, the primacy, the goal, the stated aim, the target of that attack is attacking civilians, taking hostages, and the infliction of terror on a broader populace, not a military aim. The response, then, is the Israeli Defense Force imposing siege conditions on Gaza restricting the ability of their foe to resupply and maneuver and engage them in close quarters. Keep in mind, this is not a conflict with standoff distance. Standoff distance is something that U.S. planners are very used to when we think about things, but the entirety of the Gaza Strip, again, is about the size of Queens, and Israel at its in width is only about 50 miles across, potentially, something like that. And so this is not an area where you can if you give a 10-mile buffer zone, you're giving up a third of the country, effectively.
We've got New Jersey with Queens as the area occupied by Hamas.
Exactly, right.
Yes, I know that Queens is not in New Jersey, but you get the point.
So the issue that we have then is the IDF then is imposing siege conditions and is shelling a very, very heavily populated area and trying to get these hostages back. Now, in doing so, they've inflicted about 30,000 casualties on the Palestinians in Gaza in exchange for around about 1,000 of their own, I believe. And it's part of the employment, part of the techniques that they employ are heavy use of artillery and other assets to minimize the risk to their own people. And so as they're then going through and conducting combat operations, as you might imagine, urban combat operations is about the most nightmarish and difficult and deadly of any form of combat that exists. Our own experiences, even in Iraq, in Raqqa, for instance, bear that out quite well, to say nothing of more significant conflicts. So we have judicious, restrained use of force on one hand, and we have barbarism on the other by Hamas. To those that say that Israel should be utterly precluded from using the force it is using, I would ask, what is the casualty ratio that you would like the Israelis to suffer that you would then feel morally just in them retaliating appropriately?
Right. What would you have them do? What is the alternative to dealing with an enemy that has intentionally used the people it is supposed to be protecting?
If they used human wave
shields.
Tactics, would that be better? If the Israelis killed thousands of their own men in doing so, would you feel morally superior? It's still an ugly, brutal, awful affair. But one side, at least, is judiciously employing its force.
And we are not sitting here saying that we applaud the deaths of Palestinians. The deaths of any innocents in any war is a tragedy. Frankly, the deaths of combatants is, because they typically are not the ones who started it. In this instance, however, it is Hamas fighters who entered Israel with the absolute intention, under international law, of seeking to destroy Jews in Israel. I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman. We'll be back in just a moment. Thank you for joining us on KKNT 960 The Patriot, and thanks to Seth Liebson for allowing us to sit in and host for him. Norm! Yes.
Are we depressing? Do you need a drink? Is that what's going on, Bill?
Yes, that's we are, for those of you who are listening to the podcast, it was the Cheers theme song playing for us to bring us back from our break. I'm Hugh Hallman, and I'm joined by Lewis Hallman, who's going to have to bring us in after the next break, I think. We are chatting about and trying to delve into the very subtle issue of what is genocide and why, in our view, I think collectively, those on the left who are now using the word genocide to describe what Israel is engaged in, how they're playing political games and, frankly, are legally and factually wrong. And so to start on that, I want Lewis to describe what the reality is on the ground in the Gaza Strip and how it got that way.
Right. So, you know, we mentioned tunnels earlier that were used to facilitate the attacks. These tunnels have been there for the better part of at least a decade, certainly. And they extend not only from Gaza into Israel, but also north into Syria and south into Egypt via the Sinai. And they are principally there to facilitate the smuggling of people and contraband from neighboring
weapons.
Countries into Hamas. Yeah, weapon systems generally.
And now you've got a tunnel system. Think about this. This is more extensive than the New York subway system that took a century to build out. They spent money that was supposed to have gone to assist and support the Palestinians in building new lives and businesses and infrastructure that supported the civilians. And instead, it was used and diverted to create this system that is interlocked with civilian targets built under hospitals and built under other civilian occupied infrastructure, buildings, apartments, all kinds of things, precisely to assure that any effort to get at the fighters in the tunnels would cause massive destruction to the civilian population.
And so much of the conversation about the larger conflict and the narrative around this has been about the lack of economic opportunity and the political instability in Gaza, where half of the population is younger than 18. Hamas has ruled, I think, now for, what, four decades, effectively?
Effectively, but not since Israel turned it over. So let's give them, we'll say they've had 12 years of real reign.
Fair enough.
Of real full control.
Sure, sure. And currently, the GDP per capita of the Gaza Strip is right around $3,000 or $4,000 per year, about a tenth of that of Israel. And, you know, there seems to be a consensus or some sort of meme on the left that all of Gaza's economic woes should be laid thoroughly at the feet of the Israelis. And what we just described is the theft, the plunder of $1 billion of money to uplift these people that was instead used to further militarize the population, to further smuggle arms in, rather than potentially building up the people there. So what we have is a failure of Gaza's own civilian administration that then is being politically used as a ramrod to batter the Israelis with. And further, with the existence of these tunnels, it is a massive problem for the Egyptians, for the Syrians, and the rest of the neighbors in that region, because no Arab state is sympathetic to the Palestinians on a fundamental level. They will not allow Palestinian refugees into their nations.
And name the states.
Jordan, Israel. Jordan, Egypt, Saudi, Syria, Qatar, the UAE, none of them are allowing refugees from this conflict into their societies. And instead, what we have is the Arab world universally bleeding that the Israelis and the Americans are the great Satans here to tread upon them. And what we have instead is the Arab world using the Israelis as a shaggy dog to beat and batter the Western world with, because they cannot come to grips with the fact that their institutions and societies have produced subpar results and will continue to produce these results unless something fundamentally changes.
In short, Israel's success in developing a society and an economy and agriculture and other features that support its activities and create a successful democracy and culture is causing the very problems to the Arab world. They cannot have the example of that kind of openness and freedom exercised to create a society which contrasts with the authoritarian regimes that exist. And yet, there were Arab states reaching out to Israel as recently as the Trump administration to achieve the Abraham Accords. That's an example of how things could work instead. I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman. We'll be back in just a moment. Thank you for listening with us or to us on KKNT 960 The Patriot. Thanks again to Seth Liebson for allowing us to host his show, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. I'm Hugh Hallman, joined by Lewis Hallman, the smarter two of the group in this room at the moment. And it is a great achievement for me that I married well enough that all of my sons, my children are all smarter than I am, and they also happen to be taller than I am. So that makes me the dumbest person in the household and the shortest male.
Always good to outkick your coverage.
Maybe. In this instance, Lewis, we've been talking about the use of genocide as a definition by the political left to try to paint the state of Israel and the Israel Defense Forces with the brush that they are all committing genocide on the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip in particular. And yet we note that the complaint now that Israel is preventing the import of goods, humanitarian aid, fails to mention most of the time that it's because that those resources have been infiltrated by the Hamas fighters and their supporters with additional arms and other ways to smuggle them in. You saw the horrific results about a month ago of trucks bringing in humanitarian aid being overwhelmed by people, and then the IDF being accused of murdering innocent Palestinians as mayhem was breaking out with respect to the delivery, in part likely caused by Hamas operatives seeking to prevent humanitarian aid so that they can continue to exacerbate the situation for the Palestinians on the ground in Gaza. Why? Because every day that there is another civilian death of a Palestinian in Gaza is another day that Hamas can pressure the West to stop Israel from undertaking this effort to rout the Hamas fighters from a tunnel system built under the Gaza Strip, precisely with dollars that were supposed to support the people of Gaza, the Palestinians of Gaza, to build a new life. And instead, we have this intentional effort, that word intent, intentional effort to preclude Israel from defending itself from the attacks on October 7th and other attacks, create human shields out of civilian Palestinians, and put pressure the West, as they now are successfully achieving, as you listen to Chuck Schumer and other leading Democrats now complain that Israel has gone too far. The president of these United States said that Israel has gone too far in defending itself. And while I mourn the deaths of 30,000 Palestinians, civilians who are innocents, you have to recognize the fact that every one of those deaths is at the hands of Hamas, not Israel, in the same way that every civilian death in Germany during World War II was not because the Allies were bombing Germany to end the occupation of Germany by the Nazis and the destruction of entire societies and religions. It was the fault of the Nazis and Adolf Hitler and his entire crowd. They're the ones who started the problem, and they're the ones who caused the destruction of Germany, in the same way that Hamas is entirely responsible for any destruction that is happening in the Gaza Strip and to Palestinians.
I've made this point before, but whenever I hear this sort of harm reduction moralizing from the left, the illusion that's being cast on you is that that person, for caring deeply about the suffering of others, is you know, more possessed of the spirit of goodness and
morally
charity.
Superior.
Right. And that's sort of the trick that's being cast. And so what we need to think about instead is we need to look at the reality. Because whenever you get this sort of moral grandstanding, I guarantee that the example has been cherry-picked. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a great example. I could name off the top of my head four other conflicts right now where you could make an arguable case for genocide going on. Let me see.
Real genocide.
Ukraine would be number one. I would say...
Let's talk. So that's Russia attacking Ukraine, right, and murdering civilians intentionally. Attacking civilians intentionally.
South Sudan would be another.
Brilliant.
I would say Eritrea would be another. Yemen... and the Uyghurs in China. That's five off the top of my head. I would say we've had another series of spates of coups in the Sahel, so there may be a few more down there I'm not thinking of actively. But this is not some blind concern for the impoverished driven by goodness. This is, how do I find political points that I can use to cherry pick to bludgeon my opinion of what society should be across the aisle and get my way? That's ultimately what we're talking about here. And the way that we have to beat that fight, the way we win, is not to meet them where they're at and get to a screaming match. We have to understand, what is genocide actually? What is the state of the world that's going on? If they would like to be the shrieking, emotionally responsive children, then we can be the adults in the room who can read a map.
And some of it is the hand is shown when you have mass protests by young people on college campuses shouting slogans that they don't even have any historic context or geographic understanding. From the river to the sea. Ask one of them, which river, which sea? What are we talking about? And you get blank stares. These are cute slogans to them because they want to be on the side of demonstrating their moral superiority for caring about Palestinians who are being killed in Gaza. And then they talk about, you know, an occupying force, a colonizing force in Israel. And we have to remind them, there have been Jews in Israel, in the current geography of what is Israel, for a whole lot longer than they've been alive, and for millennia. We're talking 4,000 years or more of people who have occupied an area, and now they're being called occupiers, colonizing forces, and the like. Now, is it also true that Palestinians have been in the area? Yes, that's also true. These have been successfully mixed for a very long period of time. And Israel's point about a one-state solution is there is not a reason, if you are in Israel, to have a second state, because Palestinians are welcome to be part of that society. What they are not welcome to do is to bludgeon Jews and seek their elimination.
Right. The actual founding charter of Hamas explicitly calls for the death of Israel. That is not something in Israel's own constitution about, you know, with respect to Hamas. The two are not equivalent morally.
And so in this context of the attempt to morally create moral equivalence between Hamas and the IDF forces, facts matter. History matters. And you don't see Israel having built defensive systems underneath the civilian existence throughout Israel so that there will be Jews murdered for the fun of it, for the absolute political efforts to create a hostile environment in which Palestinians and other Arabs would exist. As the concept goes, if Hamas set down its guns today and sought for peace, there would be peace. But Israel, since 1948, seeking peace, has not been able to give it or get it because there are people surrounding them that want every Jew dead. He's Lewis Hallman. I'm Hugh Hallman. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this hour.
Thank you so much for joining us. I am Lewis Hallman, joined by my father, Hugh Hallman, on The Seth Leibson Show. We have had a fascinating day today. We have talked about the state of the world, illiberal anti-Westernism. We've learned about the workings of our state House of Representatives.
And Speaker of the House, Ben Thoma.
Absolutely. And we've capped it off with a rousing discussion of the Israeli war and genocide. Quite a lot. I think the things that you should take away, if nothing else, are that institutions matter and that the society that we want to design matters. Ultimately, as we were talking about, war and peace and society are built upon our coming together and being able to continue to do the work and deliver results. You know, we are standing on the shoulders of giants, and every day we have to continue to do the work because, again, if we stop, the lights don't come on tomorrow. And so it is upon us to be grateful to the inheritance that we've received and to do our best to steward it carefully for future generations. In closing, though, I think that I would just like to say that no matter how strange and unusual the next decade seems, that we're moving into a more multipolar world, that our elections seem to be in flux, that social media is deranging us, we're still the same people. We are still human beings. We respond to the same virtues. Our nature has not changed, but our habits have. And so I would encourage you to talk to your neighbors, talk to your colleagues, engage with one another, and ultimately go out there, be kind, and do the best you can do. That is all that we can do ultimately to achieve a better world. And for all of our moralizing and grandstanding about things thousands of miles away and very, very far, there's ultimately very little that we can do. There's very little that I can do right now to affect the going on of Israel and Hamas. But what I can do is come on the radio and share my thoughts and have a reasonable conversation about where I think the world should go. And all I would ask is that all of you go out there and try to do the same.
We are students of Ronald Reagan, and it was Ronald Reagan who reminded us that what we have, the notions we have, the philosophy we benefit from, does not pass from one generation to another through the bloodstream. My sons were not born understanding this stuff fundamentally at their birth. They had it modeled for them through community service and effort by their parents and grandparents. And we must commit ourselves to continuing the process of passing on to the next generation the philosophy and principles that have made this society great. I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman. Thank you to Seth Leibson for allowing us to host.
God bless, and class dismissed.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.